Beside him, the wreck of the unidentified body made a mewling sound of pain. He seemed to have the wrong number of arms and legs, and his face was a bloody mass of twisted, unrecognizable flesh. The skyclipper was crashing. Below, Pundi rice paddies spread out in sinuous rivers, jewel-like ponds and peaceful villages. The people had gathered, waving pennants to greet his passage. But now, seeing the fireball overhead like the hammer of God, they scrambled for shelter as the skyclipper died in the air. The smaller escort craft flurried around the flaming vessel, but they could do nothing but follow. Leto tore his mind from its stunned paralysis. Romber! Victor! When suddenly he saw that the airship was hurtling toward one of the farming villages, he would crash in the midst of the gathered people. Like an animal, he wrestled with the rudders to change the angle of descent. But the flames consumed the hydraulic systems, ate away the buoyant enclosure. Most of the villagers scattered like a panicked herd. Others stared helplessly, realizing they could never get away in time. Knowing in his heart that Victor must be dead, Leto was tempted just to let himself vanish in the bright flames and the explosion. He could close his eyes and lean back, allowing gravity and heat to crush and incinerate him. How simple it would be just to give up. But when he saw all those people down there, some of them children like Victor, Leto forced back his despair, leaned forward, and fought the controls. There had to be some way to alter course and avoid the village. "No, no, no," he moaned deep in his throat. Leto felt no physical pain, only grief that ripped through his heart like a knife. He could not bear to consider all he had lost, could not waste a moment of reflexes and skill. He was fighting for the lives of the people who believed in him and relied on him. At last one of the rudders turned, and the skyclipper's nose tipped upward the barest fraction of a degree. Tearing open an emergency panel below his controls, Leto saw that his hands were red and blistered. All around the flames grew hotter and hotter. But he reached inside and tugged on the curved red levers with all his strength, hoping the escape cables and controls remained active. As the blaze in the rear of the skyclipper increased, metal clamps thumped open. The tattered dirigible sack split free, disconnected from the cockpit cabin. Guidance sails broke away and flew off in the winds, some singed, some already on fire, like flaming kites without strings. The cockpit cabin dropped off, and the remainder of the dirigible sack, suddenly freed of the weight of passengers and the thick-walled cabin, rose like a comet blazing in the sky. Correspondingly, the self-contained cabin dropped at a steeper angle. Glider wings extended, snapping into place, breaking the descent. Damaged suspensor mechanisms struggled to function. Leto pushed hard against the control grip. The hot air seemed to be melting his lungs with every breath he gasped. The tangled trees bordering soft islands in the rice marshes rose up at him. Their thorns were stiff fingers with sharpened ends, a forest of claws. He loosed a wordless howl. Even the old Duke's end in the bull ring would never be remembered as more spectacular than this final flash of glory. At the last possible instant, Leto added just a little lift and power, as much as he could wring from the damaged suspensors and engines. He skimmed past the crowded village, singeing ramshackle roofs, and crashed into the rice marshes beyond. The cockpit cabin hit the saturated ground like an ancient artillery shell. Mud, water, and shattered trees sprayed up into the air. The walls folded and collapsed. The impact hurled Leto from his seat into the front bulkhead, and then dropped him back down to the floor. Brownish water poured through ruptures in the cabin until finally, with a groan and a shriek, the wreckage came to a rest. Leto slipped into peaceful darkness. The greatest and most important problems of life cannot be solved. They can only be outgrown. Sister Jessica, Private Journal Entry. In a light tropical rain, the survivors among the senior swordmasters strode along the explosion-pocked pavement of what had formerly been the historic central plaza of the Ginaz School. Duncan Idaho, already battle-proven, stood in their midst. He had discarded his torn tunic. Beside him, he, Resser, kept his shirt on, though it was drenched in blood, mostly not his own. Both of them were full-fledged swordmasters now, but they had no desire to celebrate their triumph. Duncan just wanted to go home, to Caladan. Though it had been more than a day since the Grumman sneak attack, fire and rescue crews still worked in the rubble, using sleek dogs and trained ferrets to sniff for signs of life. But buried survivors were few. The central plaza's once lovely fountain had been demolished by shrapnel. Smoking debris lay all around. The odor of death and fire lingered in the air, not dissipated by the sea breezes. The Moritani soldiers had intended only a damaging hit-and-run strike. They had made no preparations, and had no stomach for a prolonged battle. Shortly after the Ganaz fighters rallied their weapons for defense, the Grummans left their fallen soldiers behind. They abandoned their damaged aircraft and rushed back to waiting frigates. No doubt Viscount Moritani was already publicly justifying his heinous actions and privately celebrating his sneak attack, no matter how much blood it had cost his own men. "We study and teach fighting, but Ginaz is not a military world," Whitmore Blood said. His fine clothing looked all the worse now, soot-stained and bedraggled. "We strive to remain independent of political matters." "We made assumptions and got caught sleeping," Jay Wu said, turning his perpetual sarcasm on himself for once. "We would have killed any new student for such blind arrogance, and we are guilty of it ourselves." Weary to the bone, Duncan looked at the men who had once been so proud, and saw how defeated they looked. "Ginaz should never have been a target for aggression." Rivi Denari bent over to pick up a mangled strip of metal, once part of an ornamental clockwork sculpture. "We assumed..."
"You assumed," Duncan cut him off,
and they had no answer. Duncan and his red-headed friend took the body of Trin Kronos and dumped it out into the crashing surf near the main training center, the same spot where the kidnappers had dropped the corpses of their other four victims. The gesture seemed right, the appropriate symbolic response. But the pair took no satisfaction from it. Now the gathered fighting men shook their heads in dismay as they inspected the damaged administration building. Duncan vowed to never forget the arrogance of the swordmasters, how it had led to so much trouble. Even the ancients understood the danger of hubris, of the pride before the fall. Had men learned nothing in all these thousands of years? Like his companions, Duncan now wore a swordmaster's khaki uniform and red bandana. Black bands encircled their left arms, in honor of more than 100 swordmasters who had died in the Moritani assault. "We relied on imperial law to protect us," an injured Mord Kerr said, sounding weak and small. He seemed very different from the man who had taught the drama of epic poetry and made students weep as he recited legendary stories. Both of his arms were bandaged. "But the Grummans didn't care. They have flouted our most sacred traditions, spat upon the very foundation of the Imperium." "Not everyone plays by the rules," Duncan said, unable to suppress his bitterness. "Trin Kronos told us himself. We just didn't listen to him." Rivi Denari's jowly face flushed. "House Moritani will get a slap on the wrist," Jay Wu said, his lips puckered into a frown. "They'll be fined, perhaps embargoed, and they will continue to laugh at us."
"How can anyone respect the prowess of Ginaz now?" Blood groaned. "The school is disgraced. The damage to our reputation is immense."
Mord Kerr stared up at the hazy sky, and his long gray hair hung like a shroud around his head. "We must remake the school, just like the followers of Jul Naret did, after their master drowned." Duncan studied the grizzled old swordmaster, remembered the man's tumultuous lifetime after his village had been wiped out. how he had lived a feral life in the mountainsides of Agal, then returned to join, and slay, the bandits who had killed his neighbors and family. If anyone could accomplish such a dramatic resurrection, Kor could.
"We will never be so helpless again," Rivi Denari promised,
his voice filled with emotion.
"Our premier has promised to station 2 full combat units here, and we are acquiring a squad of mini-subs to patrol the waters. We are swordmasters, righteous in our prowess, and this enemy caught us completely unprepared. We are ashamed."
With a graceful move, he kicked a twisted scrap of metal, sending it clattering into the street.
"Honor is slipping away. What is the Imperium coming to?"
Overwhelmed by his own thoughts, Duncan stepped around a splash of blood on the pavement, which glistened in the warm rain. Resser bent to look at it, as if he could draw some information from the rusty puddle, some indication of whether the fallen victim was enemy, an ally, or bystander.
"A lot of questions need to be asked," Blood said, his voice edged by suspicion. "We must dig deeply enough to find out what really happened."
He puffed out his chest.
"And we will. I'm a soldier first and an educator second."
His companions grunted in agreement. Seeing something sparkle in a pile of rubble, Duncan stepped over debris to retrieve it. He pulled out a silver bracelet, wiped it on his sleeve. Tight clusters of charms hung from the band. Tiny swords, guild highliners, ornithopters. Rejoining the others, Duncan handed it to Denari.
"Let us hope it didn't belong to a child," the bulky man said.
Duncan had already seen 4 dead children dragged from the debris, the sons and daughters of school employees. The final death toll would be in the thousands. Could it all be traced back to the single insult of expelling Grumman students, which had been a justifiable act in response to House Moratani's outrageous attack on innocent Akazi civilians, which had been caused by the assassination of an ambassador at a banquet on Arrakis, which in turn had been provoked by suspected crop sabotage. But the Grumman students had made their own choices about staying or leaving. It was also senseless. Trin Kronos had lost his life over it, and too many others with him. When would it end? Resser still intended to return to Grumman, though it seemed suicidal for him to do so. He had his own demons to face there, but Duncan hoped he would survive them, and eventually make his way to Duke Leto. After all, Resser was a swordmaster. A few of the swordmasters half-heartedly suggested offering their services as mercenaries for Ikaz. Some of the masters insisted that they regain their honor first. Skilled fighters were needed on Ginaz to rebuild the decimated school faculty. The famed academy would be years recovering from this. But while Duncan felt a deep sense of loss and anger for what had happened here, his first allegiance was to Duke Leto Atreides. For 8 years, Duncan had been forged in fire like the layered steel of a sword, and that sword was sworn to House Atreides. He would return to Caladan. Why look for meaning where there is none? Would you follow a path you know leads nowhere? Query of the Mentat School. The nightmares were bad, but waking was infinitely worse. When Leto returned to consciousness in the infirmary, the night nurse greeted him, telling him he was lucky to be alive. Leto didn't feel so lucky. Seeing his dismal expression, the male nurse with heavy spectacles said, "There is some good news. Prince Romber survived." Leto took a deep, agitated breath. His lungs felt as if he had swallowed ground glass. He tasted blood in his saliva.
"And Victor?"
He could hardly get the words out. The nurse shook his head. "I'm sorry." After a somber pause, the man added, "You need more rest. I don't want to trouble you with details about the bomb. There is time enough for that later. Sufir Hawat is investigating." He reached into a pocket of his smock. "Let me give you a sleeping capsule." Leto shook his head vehemently, extending a warning hand. I'll go back to sleep on my own.
Victor is dead.
Not entirely satisfied, but deferring to the royal patient, the nurse told him not to get out of bed. A voice-activated call unit hovered in the air over the bed. Leto just had to speak into it.
Victor is dead. My son.
Leto had known it already. But now he had to face the terrible reality.
And a bomb. Who could have done such a thing?
Despite the medical orders, the stubborn Duke watched the night nurse go into a room across the corridor to tend another patient. Romber? From his bed, Leto could just see one edge of an open doorway. Ignoring the pain, Leto pulled himself to a sitting position on the infirmary bed. Moving like a damaged Ixion mech, he levered himself up from crisp sheets that smelled of perspiration and bleach, and swung his legs over the side of the bed. His bare feet touched the floor. Where was Romber? Everything else could wait. He needed to see his friend.
Someone has killed my son.
Leto felt a surge of anger, and a sharp pain across the top of his head. His vision focused to a pinprick, and he concentrated on a tiny goal in front of him as he took one step, then a second. His ribs were bandaged and his lungs burned. Plaskin salve made his face feel stiff like soft stone. He had not looked in a mirror to see the extent of the damage. He didn't worry about scars, didn't care at all. Nothing could heal the deep, irreparable damage to his soul.
Victor was dead. My son. My son.
Incredibly, Romber had survived. But where was he?
A bomb on the skyclipper.
Leto took one more step, then another away from the diagnostic apparatus beside the bed. Outside, a cold storm blew, splattering raindrops like pellets against the sealed windows behind him. The infirmary lights were dimmed in the gloomy night. He staggered out of the room. Reeling in the doorway of the room across the corridor, he grasped the jamb to maintain his balance, then blinked before he stumbled toward brighter light inside, where the glow globes were whiter, colder. The large room was divided by a dark curtain that waved slightly in the shadows. Sharp odors assailed him from chemicals and cold air purification systems. Disoriented, he didn't consider consequences or implications. He only knew for certain, like a tolling bell in his mind, that Victor was gone. Killed in flames or sucked out with the explosion. Was it a Harkonnen assassination plot against House Atreides? A vengeful attack by the Tleilaxu against Romber? Someone trying to eliminate Leto's heir? It was difficult for the Duke to explore such matters through the fuzz of pain medications, through the stupor of grief. He could barely maintain the mental energy to proceed from one moment to the next. Despair was like a soaked blanket smothering him. Despite his determination, Leto was sorely tempted to fall into a deep, comforting well of surrender.
I must see Romber.
He slid the curtain open, passed through. In low light, a coffin-shaped life support pod was hooked up to tubes and pipes. Leto focused his efforts and took laboring steps, cursing the pain that caused his movements to falter. A mechanically operated bellows pumped oxygen into the sealed chamber. Romber lay within.
Duke Leto!
Startled, he noticed the woman who stood beside the life support pod, wrapped in Bene Gesserit robes, surrounding herself with dark colors like shadows. Tesha's drawn face was leached of its sharp humor and quiet loveliness, drained of life. He wondered how long Romber's concubine had maintained her vigil here. Jessica had told him of Bene Gesserit techniques that allowed sisters to remain awake for days. Leto realized that he didn't even know how much time had passed since he'd been pulled from the smashed wreckage of the cockpit chamber. From the haggard look on Tesha's face, he doubted she had rested a moment since the disaster.
I came to see Romber, he said.
Tesha took a half step backward and pointed toward the pod. She did not assist Leto, and he finally made it on his own to the plaz-chrome side of the vessel. He leaned heavily against the cool, polished metal seams. Breathing hard, Leto bent his head but kept his eyes closed until the dizziness passed and the pain subsided, and until he built up his nerve to look upon what had happened to his friend. He opened his eyes and recoiled in horror. All that remained of Romber Vernius was a smashed head and most of a spinal column, part of a chest. The rest, limbs, skin, some organs, had been ripped away by the force of the blast or crisped to cinders by engulfing flames. Mercifully, he remained in a coma. This was the torn mass of flesh he had seen on the deck of the Skyclipper. Leto tried to think of an appropriate prayer from the O.C. Bible. His mother would have known exactly what to say, though she had always resented the presence of the Vernius children. Lady Helena would claim this was a righteous punishment from God, because Leto had dared to take in the refugees from a sacrilegious house. Life support systems and power packs kept Romber alive, trapping his tormented soul inside this scrap of body that still clung to his existence. "Why?" Leto said to himself. "Why did this happen? Who did this to him? To Victor? To me?" He looked up and saw Tesha's stony expression. She must be using all of her Bene Gesserit training just to contain her own anguish. Although she'd been an arranged concubine, Romber had genuinely loved her. The two had allowed their match to blossom into what it could be. Unlike Leto's relationship with Kylia, and unlike his parents, whose marriage had never engendered true affection.
"Thufir Hawat and Gurney Halleck have been at the crash site for days," Tesha said. "They are investigating the wreckage to determine the responsible party. You are aware of the bomb?"
Leto nodded. "Thufir will find the answers. He always does." He forced the words from his mouth, driving himself to ask the question he dreaded most. "And Victor's body?" Tesha looked away.
"Your son was found. The guard captain, Swain Gwar, immediately preserved as much as possible, though I can't think what purpose that might serve. Gwar loved the boy, too."
"I know he did," Leto said. He stared down at the strange red and pink shape inside the life support pod, unable to recognize his friend. So closely did the chamber resemble a coffin that Leto could almost envision pulling away the wires, sealing the top, and burying it. Maybe that would be best. "Is there anything we can do for him? Or is this just a futile exercise?" He could see the muscles bunch in Tesha's cheeks, and her sepia eyes hardened, blazing with cold fire. Her voice dropped to a breathless whisper.
"I can never give up hope."
"My Lord Duke!" The night nurse's alarmed voice carried a scolding tone as he entered the room.
"You must not be up, sir. You must recover your strength. You are grievously injured, and I cannot permit you—"
Leto lifted a hand. "Don't speak to me of grievous injuries as I stand here beside the life support pod of my friend." The nurse's gaunt face flushed, and he nodded jerkily on a long, thin neck like a wading bird's. But he touched Leto's sleeve with a delicate, scrubbed hand.
"Please, my lord, I am not here to compare wounds. My aim is to see that the Duke of House Atreides heals as quickly as possible. That is your duty, too."
Tesha touched the life support pod, and her gaze met Leto's.
"Yes, Leto, you have responsibilities still.
Romber would never permit you to throw everything away because of his condition." Leto allowed himself to be guided out of the room, taking careful steps as the night nurse led him back to his bed. He knew intellectually that he must regain his strength, if only to enable him to understand the disaster.
"My son. My son, who has done this thing?"
Locked in her chambers, Kylia wailed for hours. Refusing to speak to anyone, she did not come out to see the Duke, her brother, or anyone else. But in truth, she could not face herself, the monstrous guilt, the unredeemable shame. It would be only a matter of time before Thufir Hawat and his relentless investigation uncovered her culpability. For now, no one had expressed any suspicions against her. But soon the gossip would begin, whispered along the cool stone halls of Castle Caladan. People would wonder why she was avoiding Duke Leto. And so, after learning the schedule of medications, and determining when Leto would be least likely to detect the murderous guilt in her eyes, Kailia unbolted the door of her chambers and walked unsteadily toward the infirmary rooms. At dusk, the light visible through stone-framed windows had turned the cloud banks coppery in the sky, like her hair. But she saw no beauty in the sunset, only shadows inside the walls. Medical technicians and the doctor bustled about, making way for her, backing out of the room to give her privacy with the Duke. The sympathy on their faces tore at her heart.
"He has suffered a relapse, Lady Kailia," the doctor said. "We've had to administer more drugs for his pain, and now he may be too sleepy to say much."
Kailia stood with forced hauteur. Her puffy red eyes dried as she steeled herself.
"Nevertheless, I will see him. I shall stand by Leto Atreides as long as I am able, trusting that he knows I am there."
The doctor courteously found something else to do outside the room. Her footsteps leaden, one hesitant pace at a time, Kailia moved closer to the bedside. The room smelled of injuries and pain, of medicines and despair. She looked down at Leto's bruised, burned face and tried to recall her anger toward him. She thought again of the terrible things Kiara had told her, the myriad ways Leto Atreides had betrayed all of her hopes, destroying her dreams. Still, she remembered vividly the first time they had actually made love, practically by accident after the Duke had been drinking too much Caladan ale with Guar and the guards. Laughing, Leto had spilled a mug on himself and then ambled out into the hall. There he encountered Kailia, who'd been unable to sleep and had been prowling the castle. Noting his condition, she'd scolded him gently and led him into his private chambers. She had intended to help him into bed and then leave. Nothing more. Though she had fantasized about it many times. His own attraction for her had been so plain for so long. After all they'd been through, how could she possibly have convinced herself to hate him? As she stared at him now, lying injured and motionless, she recalled how he had loved to play with his son. She had refused to see how much he'd adored the boy, because she hadn't wanted to believe it.
"Victor."
She squeezed her eyes shut and pressed her hands against her face. Tears flowed over her palms. Leto stirred and half awoke, focusing on her with groggy, red-rimmed eyes. It took him a long moment, but finally he recognized her. His face seemed free of walls and the hardness of leadership, showing only naked emotion.
"Kailia," he said in a drawn-out croak.
Not daring to respond, she bit her upper lip. What could she possibly say? He knew her too well. He would know.
"Kailia."
His voice filled with absolute anguish.
"Oh, Kailia, they've killed Victor. Someone has killed our beautiful son. Oh, Kailia, who could have done such a thing? Why?"
He struggled to keep his gray eyes open, fighting the fog of drugs in his system. Kailia jammed her fist into her mouth, biting on the knuckles until blood flowed. Unable to face him any longer, she whirled and fled the room. In a rage, Swain Guar strode up the long steps to the isolated tower chambers. Two Atreides house guards stood outside the entrance to Kailia's private rooms. "Step aside," Guar commanded. But the guards refused to move. "The Lady Kailia has given us orders," said the Levenbrek-ranked officer on the left, flicking his gaze away, afraid to oppose his commanding officer. "She wishes to be alone in her grief. She has not eaten or accepted any visitors. She..."
"Who gives you orders, Levenbrek? A concubine or the commander of our Lord Duke's troops?"
"You, sir," answered the soldier on the right, looking at his companion. "But you put us in an awkward position."
"You're dismissed, both of you.
Gwar barked. Go now. I will bear the responsibility. Then he said in a softer voice, as if to himself, Yes, I bear the responsibility. He threw open the door, strode inside, and slammed it behind him. Kailia wore a pale old sleeping garment. Her coppery hair hung in disarray, and her eyes were red and puffy. She knelt on the stone floor, forsaking the chairs, ignoring the cold, wet draft from the open window. The fireplace lay gray and dark in the palpable gloom of the chamber. Red scratches etched parallel lines on her cheeks, as if she had tried to claw out her eyes but had lost the nerve. With a shadowed gaze, she looked up at him, her expression filled with pathetic hope as she saw someone who might offer sympathy. Kailia raised herself from the floor, little more than a ghost of herself.
My son is dead. My brother mangled beyond recognition.
Her face looked like a skull.
Swain, my son is dead.
She took a step toward him and extended her hands, as if hoping for comfort. Her expressive mouth twisted in a parody of a pleading smile, but he stood rigid. My armory key was stolen, he said. Taken from my uniform belt shortly after Leto announced his plans for a ducal procession. She stopped barely a meter from her lover.
How can you think of such things when...
Thufir Hawat will learn what has happened, Gwar roared. I know now who took the key, and I know what it means. Your actions condemn you, Kailia. He shuddered, wanting to tear her heart out with his bare hands. Your own son! How could you do this?
Victor is dead, she wailed. How can you think I planned that?
You meant to kill the Duke alone, didn't you? I saw your panic when you learned that Romber and Victor had joined him in the Sky Clipper. Most of the household already suspect your hand in this. His eyes blazed and his muscles tightened, but he remained immobile as a statue. And you have made me responsible, too. Sky Clipper security was my duty, but I was slow to realize the importance of the missing key. I kept convincing myself I had only misplaced it, refused to consider other possibilities. I should have raised an alarm. He hung his head, continued to speak while he stared at the floor. I should have confessed our affair to my Duke long before this. And now you have soaked my hands with blood, as well as your own. His nostrils flared as he looked at her in revulsion, and his vision turned crimson. The room spun around him. I betrayed my Duke many times, but this is the worst of all. I could have prevented Victor's death if only... Ah, poor sweet child. Kailia's claw-like hands darted forward and grasped the hilt of the dueling dagger at Gwar's waist. She snatched it out of its sheath and held it up, her eyes glazing.
If you are so miserable in your guilt, Swain, then fall on your knife like a good warrior, like a loyal Atreides soldier. Take it. Thrust the blade into your heart so that you can no longer feel the pain.
Dully, he looked at the outstretched dagger, but refused to move toward it. Instead, after a long, intense moment, he turned away, as if taunting Kailia to plunge the blade into his back. Honor demands justice, my lady. True justice. Not an easy way out. I will face my Duke with what I have done. He looked over his shoulder as he strode toward the doorway. Worry about your own guilt. She held the dagger in her hands as Gwar left. After he closed the door, he heard Kailia wailing, pleading for him to come back. But the captain closed his ears to her cries and marched purposefully from the tower. When Kailia demanded to see her lady-in-waiting, Kiara scuttled into the room, terrified but not daring to tarry. Wind whistled through the open tower window, along with the sounds of surf crashing against the rocks far below. Kailia stared out into the distance, the breezes whipping her pale garment like a funeral shroud around her.
You summoned me, my lady?
The old woman hovered close to the doorway, allowing her shoulders to slump in an appearance of meek submission. She wished she had thought to bring a tray of spice coffee or Kailia's favorite sweetmeats, a peace offering to calm the animal fires within the distraught woman.
Shall we discuss your foolish plan, Kiara?
Kailia's voice sounded hollow and frighteningly cold. She turned, and her expression carried death. The lady-in-waiting's instincts told her to flee the castle, to disappear into Kala City and take a transport back to Gedi Prime. She could throw herself upon the mercy of Baron Harkonnen and boast about how much anguish she had caused the Duke, albeit with only partial success. But Kailia held her paralyzed, like a snake mesmerizing its prey.
I am terribly sorry, my lady.
Kiara bowed, then began to grovel.
I mourn for the innocent blood that was shed. No one could have foreseen that Victor and Romber would join the procession. They were never supposed to...
Silence! I want none of your excuses. I know everything that happened, everything that went wrong. Like a steel trap closing, Kiara clamped off further words. She felt a deeper nervousness, sensing how alone they were in this chamber. If only the guards had remained at their posts as she'd ordered. If only Kiara had thought to arm herself before coming here. So many things had been unforeseen.
As I think back over the years, Kiara, I recall so many comments you made, all those insidious suggestions. Now their meaning grows clear, and the weight of evidence is an avalanche against you.
What do you mean, my lady? I have done nothing but serve you since... Kailia cut her off. You were sent here to sow discord, weren't you? You have been trying to turn me against Leto since the day we met. Who do you work for? The Harkonnens? House Rachis? The Tleilaxu?
Sunken eyes and scarred cheeks dominated her blank and emotionless face. No matter, the result is the same. Leto has survived, and my son is dead.
She took a step toward the old woman, and Kiara used her most compassionate voice like a shield.
Your grief is making you think and say terrible things, my dear. This has all been a dreadful mistake.
Kailia stepped closer. Be thankful for one thing, Kiara. For many years I considered you my friend. Victor died swiftly and painlessly, unsuspecting. For that, I grant you your own merciful death.
She yanked out the dueling dagger she had taken from Swain Gwar. Kiara lurched backward, raising her fingers in a warding gesture.
No, my lady!
But Kailia did not hesitate. She drove forward, plunging the blade deep into Kiara's chest. She withdrew and struck again to be sure she had pierced the traitorous woman's heart. Then she let the knife fall with a clatter to the floor as a gurgling Kiara sagged like a pile of rags onto the tiles. Blood splashed the eerily beautiful blue obsidian wall, and Kailia straightened, looking at her own dim reflection there. She stared for a long moment, not liking what she saw. With ponderous steps, Kailia went to the open window. The biting cold numbed her skin, and yet all of her flesh felt wet, as if with blood. Holding the stone edges of the windowsill, she stared out into the cloud-laden sky to the distant horizon made smooth by the seas of Caladan. Below, the foaming infinity of waves snarled around the base of the tall cliff. The marvelous stalactite city inside the crust of Ix shone in her memory. It had been so long since she'd danced in the reflective halls of the Grand Palais, showing off her finest mer-silk dresses. She had stood with her brother and the Pilru twins looking out upon the immense grotto where highliners were built. Like a prayer, Kailia Vernius brought to mind everything she had read and all the images she had seen of the imperial court at Kaitain, the spectacular palace, the tiered gardens, the chime kites. She had longed to spend her life in the dazzling glamour that should have accompanied her station, princess of a great house of the Landsraad. But in all her life, Kailia had never achieved the heights or the wonders that she desired. Finally, leaving only dark memories behind her, she climbed onto the windowsill and spread her wings to fly. Humans must never submit to animals. Bene Gesserit teaching. Though Abelard formerly retained the title of sub-district governor of Lankavile, in name at least, Glossu Raban controlled the planet and its economy. It amused him to let his father keep the title, as that didn't change who was really in power. What could the old fool do anyway, hold up in a cliffside monastery? Raban despised the planet's dreary skies, cold temperatures, and primitive people with their smelly fish. He hated it because the Baron had forced him to spend years here after his botched mission on Wallach 9. But mostly he hated the place because his father loved it so much. Secure on Lankavile, Raban finally decided to inspect the remote spice stockpile they'd hidden decades before. He liked to check the hordes periodically, to be certain they were secure. All records had been erased, all witnesses eliminated. No proof existed that the Baron had secreted away so much melange during his early tenure on Arrakis. Raban mounted an expedition, coming out of orbit to set down on the northern landmass where he had spent 2 years in the industrial port cities and the whale fur processing plants. Now, with 10 of his soldiers, he navigated the ice-choked northern seas in a boat commandeered from one of the fisheries. His scanners and technicians knew where to search for the artificial iceberg. Raban let them do their work while he huddled in his cabin and drank too much Kirana brandy. He would come out on deck when the goal was sighted, but he had no interest in smelling the salty fog or freezing his fingertips until it was necessary. The synthetic iceberg was perfection to the naked eye, exactly like any other floating Arctic block. When the boat anchored, Raban shouldered his way to the front of his troops. He stepped aboard the polymer-based iceberg, operated the hidden hatch, and entered the hollow blue tunnels, only to find the enormous storehouse completely empty. When Raban let out a deep bellow, the sound echoed through the cold tunnels.
"Who did this?"
Later, the boat roared off to the south, leaving the faux iceberg behind. Raban stood at the bow, so hot with anger that the wet and cold no longer affected him. The craft raced down to the rocky fjords, where Harkonnen soldiers swarmed into pathetic little fishing villages. The settlements looked much nicer than Raban remembered them. The houses new, the equipment shiny and functional. The fishing boats and tackle, as well as the storehouses, were modern and well cared for, full of off-world imports. The soldiers wasted no time in grabbing villagers and torturing one after another until the same answer surfaced again and again. Raban had suspected even before he heard the name uttered through bloody lips and broken teeth. Abelard. He might have known. In the cliff city of Veritas, a cold winter snap came on. The Buddhist-Islamic monks used fresh water from deep mountain springs to enhance the structure and beauty of their remarkable monastery. Abelard's scarred heart had recovered as much as it ever would. Wearing warm robes and thick gloves, he held a flexible hose and spigot that sprayed a sparkling mist onto the edge of the cave opening. His breath gushed out in a cloud of steam, and the skin of his cheeks felt so cold it was bound to crack. But he smiled as he sprayed the hose, adding to the prismatic sheet wall of ice. The barricade built up slowly, like a curtain around the front of their overhanging grotto. The translucent, milky-white barrier hung down, a dome that reflected and sparkled in sunlight, yet blocked the winds that whipped around the crags. Chimes and weather vanes jangled outside the grotto and up along the cliffs, gathering power and making music at the same time. Abelard shut off the water flow and pulled back on the spigot so that monks could run forward with broken chunks of colored glass, which they positioned in the freezing water to create a kaleidoscope of brilliant hues.